Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What shared ideas and traditions make us Americans? And can we disagree about those things without writing our opponents off as un-American? My guest today is intrigued by the idea of a sort of American scripture, a collection of famous addresses, literature, and legal documents that are familiar to most of us as important to our national history and identity, even as we continue to argue vigorously over what they really mean. Stephen Protheroe is professor of religion at Boston University and senior fellow at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. His new book is called The American Bible: How Our Words Unite, Divide, and Define a Nation. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
You tell us that your purpose here is not to create a canon, but to report on one. What criteria did you use in deciding what ought to be included here?
Well, that was the hardest part of the book,
I bet.
The table of contents, not usually the case with writing a book, but that was in this case. I looked at two things. I tried to find documents that had long and vigorous commentary traditions, in other words, documents that created controversy, things that we valued enough to fight about. And then secondly, I was looking for documents that spoke to the question of the meaning of America. What is America all about? Who is and who is not a true American? So when I found a lot of buzzers going off in those two categories, that's when I pounced.
It's interesting that we're having this discussion today, because just yesterday on the program, we talked about the Aleppo Codex, which, of course, is important to Jews, despite the diaspora, because despite culture and geography being different and governments being different, people were united by this shared scripture. And the U.S. has a similar challenge in the other direction, as people come from everywhere and then take on this American identity.
That's right. And I think there's always been a keen interest in this question of what holds us together, because we aren't France and we aren't Germany, where we can talk about a common history and a shared language and a shared ethnicity for the most part. And so we've always been concerned as Americans about what's going to hold us together. And some have believed that what holds us together is a common creed, some kind of common idea. And I don't think we really have that, nor have we ever had that. But what holds us together, in my view, is this conversation that we've been having from the time of the Revolution through the Civil War and into today about, you know, who we are as a nation. And we keep referring back to these touchstones of Jefferson and Lincoln and Washington and Martin Luther King and others in having that argument about who we really are and what our country really stands for.
So, Stephen, we continue to argue about these things, but I wonder how often you have the impression that people who are making broad statements about a lot of these works have not necessarily read the originals.
You think that happens?
Yeah,
I think so. You know, and I think that's one of our troubles, that there's a way in which these texts act as touchstones and people kind of refer to them like, oh, well, Martin Luther King, he was in favor of equality, so he'd be opposed to affirmative action, something like that, without having actually looked at the text. And one thing that I'm hoping is that we will, you know, move from revering these documents to reading them, and then trying to wrestle even more deeply with what they're really all about. Because I think the conversation in our country is only going to be improved if we actually, you know, go back and read the Declaration of Independence and see if Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address is really making sense of it, and see if Martin Luther King is really making sense of Lincoln in his I Have a Dream speech.
So you start the book cleverly with a section called Genesis, including the parallels that we have long drawn between our story as Americans and the biblical story of Exodus. We consider ourselves almost a chosen people.
That's right. I mean, even though this is called the American Bible, it's not a collection of Bible verses. That's one thing I have to, I mean, at least not in the traditional sense, right? It's not Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But there is one biblical passage in the book, and that's the story of Exodus. And I believe that the Exodus story about the captivity and slavery of the Israelites in Egypt and then their liberation under the power of God across the Red Sea and toward the Promised Land, I think that is the dominant story in American life. It's the story that brought the Puritans to the New World. It's the story that slaves told themselves in the South and their hope for freedom in the North. It's the story that Mormons told themselves as they went from captivity in the East toward freedom in Utah. And it's a story that gays and African Americans and Latinos continue to tell themselves today. So I thought that was really important to underscore that. And there's some wonderful commentaries about the book of Exodus throughout American history that I included in the book.
The Declaration of Independence is here as well, and that also has been really used by Americans who feel marginalized and are looking for a confirmation of their own right to equality under the law.
Yeah, I mean, when the Declaration was first declared, the point of it really was simply to give reasons why we were separating from England. It really didn't have anything to do with equality and equal rights under the law or any of that stuff. It was really just kind of a long list of kvetches about George III. And over time, and particularly through Lincoln, in his Gettysburg Address, the Declaration becomes central. And Lincoln says at Gettysburg, he says that the United States is dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. But no one understood that to be the proposition to which America was dedicated when the Constitution was being written in the 1780s. Hmm. So that was really it was an old idea, but it was a new idea to put in the middle of the plate in the American story. And then, of course, Martin Luther King, in his I Have a Dream speech, he begins that by saying that the Constitution and the Declaration are these promissory notes, promises of equality, and Americans have not made good on that debt. They haven't paid those notes, and he was coming to the March on Washington in order to call for equality for Americans of all races.
It's remarkable in a way to consider when you have later important figures referring back to these works in history. They ultimately, in many ways, redefine those things so that today we do consider, particularly the Declaration of Independence, to be about the proposition that all humans are created equal.
Right, and this happens with scripture too, with sort of real scripture, right, in the Jewish and Christian traditions, for example, and also even in Islam, where you have to apply, as a believer, you have to apply this ancient scripture to contemporary stuff, right? Like, what are the Gospels in the New Testament say about the internet? Well, nothing really. What do they say about abortion? Well, nothing either. So as these new situations emerge, you have to try to apply the ancient text to the contemporary. And in the process, you do two things. One is you transform that original text, and the other is you keep it alive, because, of course, it would die if nobody was trying to apply it to contemporary circumstances. So that's what we do with the Constitution in the Supreme Court. For all the talk in the court about how they're just trying to apply the law, they're really not trying to write it, you know, they have to interpret the Constitution to see how it factors into privacy rights on the internet, or the TSA inspections at the airport. You know, those weren't being contemplated when the founders were writing the Constitution. And that's what keeps, it's that application to contemporary circumstances, which always gives rise to commentary and controversy, that makes these things alive, that keeps them vibrant to us and makes them very much a part of contemporary American life.
I thought it was interesting that you made the choice to include Noah Webster's Blueback Speller here. This was important because it made this bold assessment that American English was an entity unto itself, equally valid as its British parent. Talk about the impact that it had on the generations who learned from it.
Yeah, well, it was. There's some obvious things in the book, and then there's some surprises. And I think that the Blueback Speller is one of those surprises, and it surprised me as I was looking at it again. I had written a little bit about it in a prior book I did on religious literacy a few years ago, so I was familiar with Webster. I knew that Webster's Speller had been used to teach about a century of American presidents and other Americans, that it was probably the best-selling book in American life until maybe the Harry Potter series. So it was pretty important book. But what's interesting about Webster is he was very keen on teaching Americans about America and getting them to not be kind of English people overseas, you know, getting them to be Americans. And for him, that meant speaking a common language, so everybody talking in the same way, and then speaking in a way that was different from England, you know, getting rid of the yous and honor and glamour and things like that, and coming up with a standard way of spelling and a standard way of speaking. And that's why some people have referred to his speller as a cultural or linguistic declaration of independence. And it was also controversial because Webster really didn't include in his speller much about religion. At least to our eyes now, he included a lot. But in his time, he took out a lot of the references to the Bible that were included in prior spellers that other people had learned to read and write from. And part of that was that he thought that religion was going to be besmirched by association with politics, that religion should be off on its own and shouldn't be dragged into and sort of used as imprimatur for what was essentially a spelling book. And so there's less religion in his, less Bible in his Blueback Speller than there were in, say, the New England Primer or other books that were used before it to teach kids how to read.
These days, at least for a certain segment of the population, saying one is un-American and saying one is un-Christian can almost be used interchangeably. Of course, that's not the case for everybody. But I wonder if this is something that has a long history in this country or if it's relatively recent.
It's relatively recent. I think it's tricky to figure out because in the period in which you would never say that, there probably was an assumption that to be an American was to be Christian. Mm-hmm. And you only really have to start to say it when we get into the Cold War and we start to distinguish ourselves from the Soviets because they're atheists and we're Christians. And then in contemporary politics over the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a real strong move from generic language about God to specifically Christian language about God. So I think that's fairly recent. But I think the entanglement of religion and politics goes all the way back to the beginning. And, for example, George Washington's farewell address, which was a speech that I had known about before I did this book, but I hadn't really attended to it with particular care. I think it's one of the more important speeches in American history. And he has in there this idea that religion is one of the pillars of government. And this is something that people on the religious right have really gravitated toward over in recent years, and quoting him, to make their claim that the United States is a Christian nation. I don't think that was Jefferson's idea that we would have a Christian nation, but he certainly didn't imagine a kind of strict separation where religion would have no place in public life and where somehow politics would be totally divorced from religion. So I think throughout American history, we've kind of been somewhere in the middle between the people who want to strictly separate church and state and the people who really want to marry them.
Interestingly, though, in that same farewell address, Washington cautioned us against loving or hating any particular nation, including our own. I mean, loving any nation in a way that was
right.
Beyond what it, define that
right.
For us and help us understand
right.
Better than
right.
I just explained it.
Well, he has three main arguments there. One is about the importance of religion. The other is about the danger of party, which I think is such an important message nowadays. He talks about the mischiefs of the spirit of party, the tendency that people will have in a republic to put their allegiance to their party, their political party, over their allegiance to the country. And then the third point, the one that you bring up, which is really important, he's often quoted as speaking about no entangling alliances, although that is actually Jefferson's language later, but the sentiment is there in the farewell address. And he talks about how we don't want to love or hate any other nation too much. And I think that's precisely what Americans have done over the last 100 years in foreign policy, is that they have loved some nations too much and they have hated some nations too much. And Washington says both of those are dangerous. Both of those turn us into a slave of the other society. If we're totally preoccupied with the Soviets during the Cold War, we are just so focused on hating them, then we're going to get into trouble like we did in the Bay of Pigs in Cuba. And if we're so focused on loving another country, like perhaps we are now about Israel, for example, we might get into trouble of a different kind of sort. And he says, just kind of keep your cool, you know, almost like the guy in high school who's like really not that interested in the girls and really not, you know.
That's who everybody wants. Let me jump in and we'll take a quick break here. Stephen Prothero is my guest. His new book is called The American Bible, How Our Words Unite, Divide, and Define a Nation.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephen Prothero. He's professor of religion at Boston University and senior fellow at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. His new book is called The American Bible, How Our Words Unite, Divide, and Define a Nation. Join the conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Stephen, you mentioned a few minutes ago that it was after the Cold War that a lot of more specific religious language found its way into shared national texts. And one really interesting example here is the Pledge of Allegiance, which, of course, existed for a very long time before the words under God were inserted.
Right. We got the Pledge of Allegiance in the 1890s, and we had some controversy about it in terms of whether we should be forcing kids to stand up and say particular words. Maybe that was something that we shouldn't do. Maybe that was something that fascists might do or Nazis might do, but maybe we shouldn't do it. But the big controversy came, and a lot of Supreme Court decisions or arguments came with inserting under God, which is language that actually Lincoln used in the Gettysburg Address, had been floating around before in American society with this idea of Americans as a chosen people. And then under Eisenhower during the Cold War, that became a way to distinguish ourselves from the Soviets, that they didn't believe in God and we did. We were one nation under God and they were one nation without God. And that added a whole new layer of controversy because it seemed to say that the United States was somehow a monotheistic country, and therefore people who were atheists or even people who were polytheists who believed that there was more than one God might really not be true Americans.
And it's interesting, you also include some text from a speech that Ronald Reagan made here in Dallas in 1984, at which he lamented the fact that perhaps we had sort of lost, as Americans, the protection of God since the 1960s.
Yeah, I struggled with what to include for Reagan because he has so many really iconic and important speeches. He has, you know, Mr. Gorbachev tear down that wall, mm-hmm. and he has his speech about the evil empire. But I think the classic Reagan utterance is this speech that's been called A Time for Choosing. It's also been called simply The Speech, delivered in 1964 on behalf of Barry Goldwater. And there he really lays out what becomes the ideological stream of the Republican Party for the next half century, you know, right up until today. And he does a number of things in that speech. One is he takes aim at the 60s. And he talks this moral language about how the Republicans are really the party that is not going along with the moral relativism of the 1960s. And then he also talks about how the dangers of communism aren't just abroad, but they're also inside our own country, that we have a kind of socialist creep where we're gradually expanding and expanding the jobs of the state and raising taxes in order to support it. And that critique becomes particularly prominent there. But what's missing in the speech, which was fascinating to me, is this kind of exuberance and optimism that we associate with Reagan, this kind of, you know, it's always the morning in America when you wake up. And that's really not there. It's kind of a dour, gloomy sort of speech and quite different from things we would later expect of Reagan. But a lot of the building blocks for what we now think of as the Reagan Revolution can be found in that speech.
I think it could fairly be argued that Ronald Reagan has become one of the sort of secular saints of this country, along with, you know, everyone from the Founding Fathers to Martin Luther King. Can you talk about how once we have sort of declared an American to be a great American, the mythology mixes with the reality of what they might have said and what they might have stood for?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's right. And, you know, once they're gone and they can no longer speak for themselves, I think that process starts, mm-hmm. and we then take over for them. This is something you see in literature about saints and martyrs. You know, who makes a saint and a martyr? It's not the person themselves. It's the believers who decide after they die that they are, you know, this kind of person, you know, a person to be revered. And I think that that's absolutely happening with Reagan. I think that you can see in the Republican Party, in the primaries, this real desire to be the next Ronald Reagan. But at the same time, you see all sorts of contradictions between what Republicans do today and what Reagan was doing. I think, you know, I thought Reagan was pretty far to the right when he was running for president in 1980, but I think he would be far too far to the left now to get elected or to get the nomination of the Republicans, because he, you know, he was willing to raise taxes, for example. He was willing to work with the Democrats in the House and the Senate in order to pass legislation.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Scott in Plano. Hi, Scott.
Hi. This sounds like a very fascinating book, and although I haven't, since I haven't read it, I hate to put any criticisms, but it sounds like also it could be a book that just focuses on the kinds of documents or ideas that we all like now. And yet I wonder if you have anything in it that would be like the Dred Scott decision or others who are arguing for slavery, for example, either before or after the Civil War, that were very influential also.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a good question. Is this all just kind of the sunny side, the cheery side of American history? My answer is that, yeah, there is discussion in the book of the Dred Scott decision. There is discussion of this kind of seamy side of American life, particularly when it comes to slavery and when it comes to segregation. Mostly, though, those, for example, the Dred Scott decision that's really, you know, excluding African Americans from citizenship, that is not included as one of my core texts, because I don't think it has the kind of iconic status that Brown v. Board of Education does. But the debates about slavery are definitely in the book. We hear the voices of Lincoln, but we also hear the side of Douglas in the Lincoln Douglas debates. And the same goes with conversations about the Constitution, of people who are in favor of states' rights, people who are in favor of a strong central government. All these kind of central debates we have in American society, they're all represented in the book, and both sides are represented. In fact, in my hometown newspaper here in Boston, the Boston Globe, they did a review where the complaint was that there were too many conservative voices in the book, and that it should have been a more liberal book.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Will in Fort Worth. Hi, Will.
Hi. I was just wondering how had Ayn Rand's ideas permeated through American culture?
Ayn Rand, I don't know if you could hear that, Stephen, and this was the only text you wished to include that you weren't able to actually copy in the book.
That's right. Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged is in my book. I have in the section on Chronicles, I have three novels, Huckleberry Finn, which is important, of course, for being, according to some, the most racist book in American literature, and then according to others, the most anti-racist book in American literature. So it's a classic case of controversy. And then I also have Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe, the anti-slavery novel that some think is the most important book ever published in America for helping to bring the North around to being willing to go to war in the Civil War. And then I included Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged because I think it's the classic example of the argument on behalf of capitalism. Capitalism as a moral good, greed as a moral good. Long before Wall Street and Gordon Gekko said greed is good, Ayn Rand was saying the same thing. So she's in there. But unfortunately, we weren't able to reprint this great speech by this gentleman, D'Anconia, this copper magnate who's in the book, on the virtues of money, because the estate of Ayn Rand wouldn't allow us to include it in the book because they didn't want it to be alongside criticisms. And luckily, that was the only person who said no to us. I think the rest appreciated this idea of presenting these core texts alongside arguments about them, both pro and con, and seeing that as very much a part of the American project.
Let's talk a little bit more about The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, which I think Americans today forget that although the events took place before the Civil War, in fact, it was written after the Civil War, when Mark Twain was clearly aware that our problems with figuring out race and equality were just beginning.
Right. Well, oh my gosh, there's so much written about Huck Finn because, it's been in our canon. It's been in our high schools for decades. And what to me is fascinating about the book is, first of all, it attends to what I see as the major challenge in American history, which is the challenge of race. And we have all sorts of challenges around gender and around class and all sorts of questions. But I think race is the question that gave us our Civil War. It's the question that has defined the nation more than any other. And Huckleberry Finn attends to that in a way that's entertaining, that gives us a new way of writing novels, really, in the vernacular. So we get to hear this kid talking the way kids spoke in the South before the Civil War. We got to hear the language of the slave, Tom, who very much turns around into this Uncle Tom characterization that Malcolm X would go on and label Martin Luther King and Uncle Tom, even though the Tom character in the book is at least intended by Stowe to be very... I skipped over to Uncle Tom's Cabin. I'm sorry.
It's easy. Well, they're in the same chapter.
The books in my, but at any rate, in the Huck Finn story, you have the use of the N-word over 200 times, and this is really offensive to a lot of African-Americans today who just think it ought to not be in our libraries and shouldn't be in our schools. And yet others say, no, this is the great American novel. It brings so much into American literature in terms of its focus on the vernacular. And it also is a classic statement of opposition to racism. So is it a racist book or is it an anti-racist book? That's the big question about Huck Finn.
I want to talk about this for a minute because you remind us here that things have been worse, that we do stand a chance at moving back to a period of more civil discourse. Do you think, though, that the fact that, you know, in past generations, we weren't arguing yet about things like America's role in the world, about weapons of mass destruction, about same-sex marriage, about abortion, until relatively recently. Did that keep people from these entrenched positions that they've taken today?
You know, I don't think so. I don't think the change is that the issues have become more momentous, because in some ways the issues were more momentous in the beginning when we had a country that we thought at any moment might fall apart. I mean, that's what many Americans believed when the election of 1800 ended in a tie that between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, that whoever ended up becoming the next president, the people who opposed him were going to fight, that we're going to have civil war. And the questions about the power of the central government, the role of the states, those were hugely important questions. And I think it more monumental in some way than the question is today of gay marriage. I think certain things have changed. One is the arrival of religion into the center of American political life. And that with it has come the language of sort of absolute good and absolute evil, a kind of light and darkness language that you can see often in religious institutions, but that we had avoided until relatively recently in American life. I think that's one thing. I think a second change that's brought on our kind of partisanship epidemic has been the rise of cable news and also a commercial talk radio, which has really polarized us and taken us back to a situation that we had in the early Republic when all our newspapers and all our media were basically partisan, and it was much easier to drum people up into kind of fever craziness like we had in the election of 1800. I think that's changed. And then another thing that's changed, and this is an argument I make in the book, is that we have forgotten the voices, the great voices of conciliation in American public life, the people who tell us, let's be Americans first, let's be Republicans or Democrats second. And all these great figures in this book make that argument. Thomas Jefferson makes it in his first inaugural when he says, we are all Republicans, we are all Federalists. John Kennedy, in his inaugural, says that civility is not a sign of weakness. Patrick Henry says, you know, I'm not a Virginian, I'm an American. And I think we've lost that. I think we've forgotten that. And I think that we're kind of playing this game. It's almost like sport, that we're trying to win the argument or we're trying to put down the other party. And we've forgotten that the purpose of our public life is to create a common space for the common good. And I think the more we listen to these voices in the book, the more we can be called back to that higher purpose for our country.
You know, when we think about Americans who really stood for and modeled civil disobedience, we think of Martin Luther King. We think of people like Cesar Chavez. We don't necessarily, in this time and age, think about Henry David Thoreau.
Yes, although he's the one who really gave us that tradition in American life. It was funny to make the decision to not include Walden, which so many people read at least in New England, in high school, and to include civil disobedience instead. But I think civil disobedience is probably the most powerfully influential essay ever written by an American. And, you know, what happened there was Thoreau was off in his cabin in Walden Pond, and the guy, the tax collector, came to collect his poll tax, and Thoreau refused. And he refused because he didn't like the Mexican War, and he didn't like the fact that Northerners, according to the Fugitive Slave Act, were supposed to be turning in slaves if they saw them. And he didn't like the way Americans were treating Indians. And he said, I can't be a part of it. And he made this argument on the basis of a kind of higher law of individual conscience that the place for a just person in New England at the time was in prison. And he was only there for a day. He was annoyed because a friend came and paid his bill. He wanted to stay. But he wrote this wonderful essay about the importance of civil disobedience that, yes, it was read by Martin Luther King and it was read by Gandhi. And in that way, this essay helped to inspire the movement for Indian independence and the movement for civil rights in the United States.
I didn't realize until I read your book that Francis Scott Key actually opposed our participation in the War of 1812.
I know. He got this kind of fit of patriotism when he's aboard a boat during a battle outside of Baltimore, and he's worried about what's going to happen. Is that city going to be burned down by the British in the War of 1812? And he's on actually a British boat. It's a long story about how he gets there. He's trying to help a prisoner get released. And as he wakes up in the morning, he's not sure what flag he's going to see flying over Fort McHenry. And he thinks it might be the British flag, but he looks and he sees an American flag. And that flag is now in the Smithsonian in the Museum of American History. And, of course, he gave us this song that many complain is so hard to sing. You have to be Whitney Houston in order to sing it. Or Jimi Hendrix to play it on your guitar.
Stephen Prothero is with us. He's professor of religion at Boston University. His new book is called The American Bible, How Our Words Unite, Divide, and Define a Nation. Join this conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Stephen Prothero is my guest. He's professor of religion at Boston University and senior fellow at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. His new book is called The American Bible, How Our Words Unite, Divide, and Define a Nation. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. You also include here, Stephen, Maya Lin's Vietnam Veterans Memorial, which is a fascinating choice because people think of it as sculpture, they think of it as a monument, but they do not think of it as a text in any classical sense. But Maya Lin herself thought that in many ways it was like a book.
That's right, and this was one that was suggested to me by a friend, and I just sort of looked at her and said, "Are you kidding me? That's not a book." And she said, "Think about it." And I did. And I started to research it a little bit. I had actually been in Washington, D.C. when that was being built in 1982. So I had a sort of keen interest in the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. And then I researched it and I found out that Maya Lin, who designed it, who won a competition, by the way, when she was a senior at Yale, an undergraduate, a competition, by the way, that was entered by her professor in a funerary architecture class she was taking, who did not win, obviously, but she had said that she saw it as a book, a kind of open book that was cut into the earth with these two big black reflective granite pages, and on each page were written words, and the words were not, you know, in the beginning as in Genesis, but they were a listing of the 58,000 plus service people who died in the war in Vietnam. And so I took that to heart, and I started to research it. And, of course, it was an amazing controversy about that memorial, even before it was built, about how it was black instead of white, how it was a black gash of shame, how it refused to see the Vietnam as a noble war, how it saw America as a place that was in somehow besmirched by the war. And yet, when it opened, it did exactly what Myelin predicted it would do. It made the people who came there to remember their loved ones cry, and it made them hunt for the people's names, and it was just an incredibly powerful memorial that provides a kind of open slate or a blank slate or a kind of open canvas for each of us to decide what we think ourselves of the war and America's role in it.
I think that's so true, and I also think it's remarkable that it's impossible to visit without becoming part of that reverent shared experience.
Well, what's fascinating for me as a religious studies scholar going down to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial is that it does create the sacred space there. You know, I think I refer to it as a kind of American Lourdes, as a kind of pilgrimage site where we go to commune with the dead and to think about the purposes, the meaning, and end of America. And people do act like they act when they walk into a church. They lower their voices. They start to whisper. They move slowly. They kind of turn inward in a contemplative sort of way. They realize they're in the presence of something powerful, you know, and what is that thing? Well, maybe it's God, maybe it's death, maybe it's intimations of their own mortality. You know, maybe it's something about American history. You know, I'm not sure what it is, but there's something sort of ineffable and awful there in the old sense of that word of filled with awe.
And I guess the question that remains to be answered there is whether or not that awe will be sustained after the war is no longer in living memory for any Americans who go visit.
Right. And I have to say, that was my reluctance about including it. It's actually the most recent book in the American Bible, 1982. So it's, you know, 30 years old now. It's going to have its 30-year anniversary in November. And the question is, yes, I mean, it's had a sustained period of controversy, but what happens when the people who lived during the Vietnam era die? You know, is it going to still resonate? And I think the answer is that it won't resonate in the same way. But I think that the questions that monument and memorial puts on us in terms of questions about war are really profound, and I don't see those going away. You know, when is it worth fighting a war? What makes a war just? You know, when is a war a noble cause, and when is it a lost cause? I think that memorial presents those questions really powerfully, and I can imagine it living on even after people who were alive during that war have passed.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go back to the phones now. We have Jim on the line in Dallas. Hello, Jim.
Hello. Thank you. My question is, after Goldwater was involved in the election of 64, the Republican Party just became, to me, sort of irrelevant. And Nixon realized that. And I think that speech he gave, that referred to as the speech, where he adopted the idea that the Southerners were being left behind and that they could be of use to him, and the Southern strategies just turned the Republican Party into this a party of the racist, and have become more and more reactionary, and in that respect, ever since. And I just wonder what you thought of that speech in particular.
Well, the speech in my book is not a Nixon speech, although Nixon is there as a commentator in the book on a number of issues. The speech that I have in there is Reagan's endorsement of Goldwater in 1964. And I do think that the horrible loss that Goldwater took in 1964 really did cause a kind of crisis of conscience in the Republican Party. And I think that's part of what helped to catapult Reagan to a position of importance, because it was clear that even though Goldwater had lost the election, that in a way Reagan had won it for himself by giving this speech that everybody sort of hailed. And so as people started to turn to ideas, they started to turn toward Reagan and his speech. Now, there was also this Southern strategy that Nixon used to basically become the party that was cultivating the Southern votes by, you know, refusing to push for equality between the races, you know, by pandering to Southern racism. And there's no doubt that that was part of the rise of the Republican Party. And it's something that both parties are wrestling with today.
Talk a little bit about JFK's famous speech, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
Well, I had a whole chapter in the book initially on that speech because I think it's a terrific and important speech. I think, obviously, Kennedy is an iconic figure in American history. But we need to cut the book back a little bit. Too long. So that became part of my proverbs section where mm-hmm. I have these single lines or phrases surrounded on a page by commentary, much like you'd see in the Talmud in Judaism, which has a central scripture in the middle of the page and commentary that surrounds it. And the line I picked, of course, was, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, which Kennedy delivered in his wonderful, you know, Massachusetts accent that we all love around here. I'm from Cape Cod. But, you know, what's interesting to me about that line is it's call for sacrifice, and it seems that we've forgotten that. It seems that the push now is to kind of have government not bother us. Like, why is government bothering me? Why are my taxes so high? You know, why is it doing too much? Kennedy's idea there really was that the United States was a kind of a gift, and that we who were recipients of the gift owed something back to it in form of service. And the obvious service that flowed out of that for Kennedy was the Peace Corps. But I think there was a broader call, which was, you know, when we get in a point of crisis, or when the world gets in a point of crisis, that we all should pitch in. And I think that's something that we've forgotten. You don't hear that from leaders anymore, either Democrat or Republican. You're not going to hear anybody stand up and say, we need sacrifice from you, we need to raise your taxes, or we need sacrifice from you. You know, we need you to pitch in and do this, this, and that. It really has become much more pandering to voters and just telling them what they want rather than leading in the old-fashioned sense of leadership. And I think Kennedy was doing that in his inaugural.
When you talk about pandering, which certainly happens on both sides of the aisle, it's almost as if politics has become a consumer product, and that's the way we talk about things. We need to sell other people on our ideas, whether or not we're selling them the entire product.
Yeah, I think that's really astute, and I think that's new. You know, I think that's within the last generation or two generations, this idea that you're selling the candidate and that you're selling a product and that you're testing the market through marketers about how a given soundbite is going to work or how a given position is going to go. And we are lacking for the kind of leadership that says, you know, to hell with the polls. You know, this is the right thing to do. This is what we should be doing. And you know, ironically, I actually think that would sell. You know, in other words, the stuff we imagine wouldn't sell, I think might sell. And I think Americans sometimes want to be challenged. They want to have a leader. That's been one complaint about Barack Obama, that it seemed when he was elected, at least by people in the center and the left, that he was going to be a leader who was going to take us places that we might be surprised that we were going to go with him. And that really hasn't materialized in his first term, at least. And that's part of the you know, part of the disappointment with him. And, you know, in the past, we had a lot of leaders who certainly all our politicians have always sort of held up their finger and figured out which way the wind was blowing. But there's a lot more of that, I think today. And I think politics has become more of a consumer product and less of a sort of what can we do for our country? How can we make this a better place?
We can't finish this conversation without speaking at least a little bit about the I Have a Dream speech by Martin Luther King, which has been invoked to different purposes by everybody from Malcolm X to Rush Limbaugh.
I know. It's amazing how, you know, that was given in my lifetime, and yet it's being used now as an argument against affirmative action on the grounds that King's vision, King's dream, was a place where we would judge everyone by the content of their character instead of the color of their skin. And that's just one example. But, you know, these kind of speeches are they're not public policy speeches, right? If they were public policy speeches, they wouldn't resonate in the same way. They have a kind of timelessness about them. That's true of the Gettysburg Address, which doesn't talk about the North or the South. It doesn't mention slavery. It's sort of a meditation on death and mortality, and then on the purpose of the American experiment. And I think King's is similar. You know, King's speech in essence is, this place was meant to be better than it is now. I take that to be kind of the heart of it. And I think that's what Lincoln was also about, that we should, you know, our hopes should go farther than our arms, you know, something like that. And so under those circumstances, what you have is this sort of an somewhat abstract and somewhat vague kind of speech that can then be used in all sorts of different directions, and the I Have a Dream speech has certainly done that. What's interesting about it, and what makes it, I think, American scripture, part of the American Bible, is that it's not something you can attack. You know, you can't stand up as either a Republican or a Democrat and say, well, but Martin Luther King was really dumb. You know, what he said in the I Have a Dream speech, we can't have that. You know, even Rush Limbaugh knows that, and he's going to claim the authority of King for himself rather than trying to take on the authority of King.
What has changed about the way we argue about these things? As you point out in the book, they continue to be part of the way we talk about this country because all of these ideas are important enough to argue over. So how is the style of arguing different today, and what does it take to get back to a more civil, respectful debate right over these issues?
Well, there's a wonderful distinction that's made in the Jewish tradition between two types of arguing. And the first is called arguing on behalf of God. And the idea is that you have two or more people who each has partial knowledge, partial wisdom, who doesn't know precisely the truth in a given circumstance. And they're going to argue in order that they can get closer to the real truth, closer to the way that God sees the situation. And so that is an argument, but it's a kind of a collaboration, because the understanding is that you're both learning something from it. And then there's a second kind of argument, which is arguing on behalf of yourself or arguing to win. And we all know what this kind of arguing is, right? We're upset, you know, whatever. Somebody's turned the wrong way in the car, somebody's bought the wrong thing, or whatever it might be. And we start to have an argument, and it really isn't about listening. It isn't about searching for the truth. It's just about winning. And I think that that's what's happened to our politics, is that we've gone from arguments that are about our country to arguments that are about winning on behalf of ourselves or of our party. And so they've become kind of like party ego contests. I think what we need to do is we just need to get back to these, not only to, you know, reading and hearing what these people have to say in this book, but how they say it. You know, how does Lincoln make his argument with Douglas? He's not denouncing Douglas as un-American because he has different views about slavery. He's not telling him that he's evil. He's not telling him that, you know, he ought to go to Russia because he's a Stalinist or something, to speak anachronistically. But that is what we do now. We very quickly tried out the Nazi language or the socialist language or the un-American language, and we sort of exile our political people who disagree with us politically from the American conversation, and we certainly see that on...
I have to jump in here. I'm sorry, we're out of time. Stephen Prothero's new book is called The American Bible, How Our Words Unite, Divide, and Define a Nation. Stephen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can check out upcoming programs and download the podcast at kera.org/think or send email to think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.